In many ways, we could see what we're engaged in this practice and walking this path that the Buddha taught with the tool of insight meditation as an exploration and a movement towards finding balance. And I think it was Marie, one of the others, spoke about the Buddha's naming of his teaching, what he offered. He described it as the middle way, this middle between extremes of self-indulgence in one hand and self-denial or mortification on the other. And he'd been raised in one of those, and he took the other one to such extremes that he nearly died in his austerities of mortifying the flesh in his ascetic period of practice. And in his very first teaching, the teaching setting in motion the wheel of the Dhamma, he made, this was part of that, he said, without veering towards either of these extremes, the Tathagata, his name for himself, has awakened to the middle way, which gives rise to vision, which gives rise to knowledge, which leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment. And what, practitioners, is that middle way awakened to by the Tathagata, which gives rise to vision and so forth? It is this noble eightfold path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. So he elaborated it in this first discourse. He went on, it was the teaching on the Four Noble Truths, and this Eightfold Noble Path is the eighth one of those. And this movement towards balance shows up in our lives and our practice in a number of ways. It's the balance that we are constantly refining and rediscovering between effort and non-effort, or balanced effort, or relaxation. That's always changing. Sometimes our practice demands that we summon everything we can bring just to show up for life. And at other times, we have to let go of anything that even remotely looks like effort. We find balance in terms of the balance of energy and tranquility. If there's too much tranquility in the meditation that's not balanced by effort, that we will fall into a kind of what's called sinking mind, where the mind will fall into a kind of a dull, almost stupor-like state. There's too much energy, not enough tranquility, the mind falls into restlessness, agitation, excessive thinking. So that's another way we find balance. We need to have balance in terms of our assessment of who we think we are. You know, we in the situation, what we're doing in practice, we find balance between the extremes of seeing ourselves as somehow flawed, and we treat ourselves and approach our practice as though we are a problem that has to be fixed. But then being realistic that there are things to be explored here, a realistic assessment of the situation. We find balance in terms of opening to suffering in our own mind and heart, in the world, and the immensity of that, and getting overwhelmed by it and falling into despair and hopelessness in the face of the magnitude of it. It can seem so huge, like a huge wave just about to break, miles high, kilometers high. And so this movement towards balance really characterizes this journey, if we want to think of it that way. We have to be careful with this image of a journey because, as I've been saying, and the others as well in different ways, we aren't going from here to there. We're going deeper into here. We're not getting something we don't already have. And so this understanding, you could say the realization of the Buddha, could be seen as the complete development of this, the culmination, the perfection of this quality of balance. The mind, the heart, resting in the deepest possible balance. Unshakable, unassailable in the face of life's changes. There's a very deep stability of mind and heart. This is a verse from, there are two collections of verses, of, you could call them poems, that were written, said to have been spoken by the disciples of the Buddha. The Theragata is the monks, and the Therigata is the nuns, and they're quite beautiful. I love the nuns' poems especially. Some of them are just beautiful. Often they're a description of their struggles and the movements in their path and practice in different ways, and often they have these beautiful descriptions of the moment of their awakening. And sometimes they're very surprising. You know, we picture, oh, they must be sitting in deep, deep samadhi concentration, and you know, and then they maybe float up into the air and drift off in a rainbow light or something. But often they say the equivalent of I reached to turn out the lights and my mind was free. I watched the water that I had been washing my feet with flow down the hill. I sat down and my mind was freed. These different descriptions. It's beautiful to read these. They're just, you know, brushing my teeth. It points to the importance of mindfulness of daily activities and the in-between times. The Buddha's attendant Ananda is said to have realized the final stage of enlightenment. A certain way of looking is talked about in stages, as he was going from standing to lying down. On the way down. Getting into bed. So pay attention. You never know. Next time you flush the toilet, really be there. It could be the catalyst for this opening. Anyway, this verse, I believe it's with one of the nuns, it says, this is part of it. If your mind becomes firm like a rock and no longer shakes in a world where everything is shaking, your mind will be your greatest friend and suffering will not come your way. I love this sense or idea, this sense here of the mind becoming your greatest friend, which has been in other talks, this sense of, it was in the samurai poem, I make my mind my friend, that we don't often relate to our mind as our friend, I think. Certainly I didn't start with that. When I first came to this practice, I think I would have regarded my mind as my enemy. It seemed to be just trying to make life hard for me, persuade me that I was worthless and hopeless and all kinds of untrue but very believable to me things. But I can say after this many years that it is my true and best friend. That's a huge change. That's no small thing to see that, to get a taste, any sense at all of that possibility. If we get nothing more out of our time here than some taste of the possibility that we could have a mind, a heart that is our true friend, our ally, maybe even our best friend, then our time will have been so well spent here. And maybe this is true for you. But so often we're in contention with our own inner world and with our mind in some way. And all the things we tell ourselves about how we're something wrong with us. Something we have to fix. This verse, it talks about this image, firm like a rock, and that could be a sense, well, that it's hard and somehow immobile. But in my mind, this image brings to the sense of a, maybe even you could say like a mountain. You know, this steadiness and this non-resistance, this deep sense of stability and acceptance there, and that kind of firmness. And the firmness of a mind that doesn't shake in a world where everything is shaking is this sense of resting in this quality of deep balance there. The world is shaking and we remain unshakable in that, but not immobile or hard or shut down in any way. So it's the mind, heart imbued with the quality of equanimity, which we've mentioned in different ways this week. It's one of the four divine abidings, the Brahma Viharas. Equanimity is said to be the most sublime of these, the most subtle and the most deeply sweet, you could say, the most profound. And it points to this kind of openness to experience, so it's fully connected. It's not closed off or withdrawn or detached in some unfeeling or disconnected way. But there's the mind is not pushed and pulled about. It's not reactive to the changes. It's responsive. That's a difference. Do you have that difference? Responsive versus reactive, and is there a way to say that in Finnish? Kind of hard to translate. Anyway, I hope you can probably get. Hopefully, you're with me on this. Sometimes I worry that words are not so clear. And it's powerful in its own right, and it also supports other qualities. So it supports the development of wisdom, because when our mind is not shaking, and there's this balance and steadiness, we can rest with the reality and the truth of things long enough to drop below the surface, and the possibility that deep insight and wisdom can arise then. And we can rest in the moment as it is, free of struggle, resistance, or some form of identification that pulls us off balance. So then we can see deeply into the conditioned nature of experience, of all experience. We see it's this flowing on, this causal flow. And it gives us the possibility that we just don't take everything so personally. It supports and empowers metta, karuna, mudita, kindness, goodwill, compassion, appreciative joy. In fact, it's woven into them. They rest on it. This is from a German monk who was in very early monk in Sri Lanka. Very scholarly and deep practitioner named Jnanaponika Thera. Equanimity is the crown and culmination of the four sublime states. These four Brahma Viharas. But this should not be understood to mean that it is somehow the negation of love, of compassion, of appreciative joy, or that it leaves them behind somehow as lesser. Far from that, equanimity includes and pervades them fully. just as they fully pervade and perfect equanimity. They're woven together. True equanimity is imbued with goodwill, with compassion, with this quality of appreciation and delight in the good fortune of others. And they are what allows them to develop to their fullness is this quality of balance. It gives metta, the quality of metta to, it has the patience and a kind of non-attached perspective so that we can open and care even when those that we love do self-destructive things. We don't have to throw them out of our heart. It fosters this courage and strength within compassion, within karuna, that allows us to actually show up and meet the suffering that we find in our own inner world and in the world around us, to actually show up for that part of life which is inescapable. It will be there at times. Sometimes, really, in a big way. And it allows us to act. It gives us enough balance that we can act and take action when it is possible to alleviate suffering. We take action. Compassion is a verb in so many ways. It's not passive in any way. To name injustice, to draw firm boundaries, to say no, but not from anger, from a place of balance. So we can be with suffering when there's something we can do. It allows some clarity, perspective to see. And when there's nothing we can do, it doesn't withdraw or falter or somehow abandon the situation. It can stay there when all we can do is bear witness and not pull away and stay. There was an article I read some time ago by a teacher in California, I think we've mentioned, named Gil Fronsdahl, who's a Pali scholar, has a PhD in Buddhist studies, I think, and is a really good teacher, deep practitioner. And he, in this article, he said that there are two words in the Pali language, both of which could be translated as equanimity, and they point to two different aspects of this sense of this balance, this quality. So the first one is upekkha, which maybe many of you are familiar with, and it's the word that usually gets translated as equanimity. It's the word that is used for that Brahma vihara, that divine abiding. Metta karuna mudita upekkha, so it's used there. And it means something literally like to look over. And it points to as though you're standing on a high place and can look out over an area. And it points to the aspect of equanimity that has to do with seeing the broader kind of picture. So it allows us to not get so caught up in all the details of things. We see this and rest back in a broader kind of view. And I think in the article, Gil compared it to what he called the love of a grandmother for her grandchildren. He said the grandmother, because she's already raised her own children and gone through that, she's much less likely, she loves them, but she doesn't get caught up in all the apparent dramas there that the mother might, because she's seen it before. And so she can have a bigger view of, you know, the things that we all go through in life. And then the second word is one of these, sometimes Pali has, I don't know if, are Finnish words really long because you put things together? Yeah, so it's a lot like Pali. Pali, you put, if you want to make a certain word, you put other ones together. This one is made of, this might even be kind of like a Finnish word. Tatra majatatta. Sounds like Finnish to me, sort of. But it's made of these three words. Tatra means, it could mean there, or it could mean all these things. all these things, all those things there. Majja means middle. And those of you who are familiar with the collection of texts, there's one called the Majjhima Nikaya Majja, same word there, means middle length teachings. And tatta, which means to stand, or maybe even to pose. And so you put together, they mean to stand in the middle of all this, or to stand there in the middle. And I see this as pointing to this sense of remaining centered in the middle of what's going on. This kind of stability, strength. So it's like an internal strength. So the one is this broad view and the other is this internal strength that lets us remain stable in the middle of all that's going on, all that's there. And this sort of well-being and confidence, a certain kind of inner integrity. And it reminds me of this sense of this internal balance. When I was living in San Francisco, my roommate and I were renting an old converted fire station that dated to before there were motorized fire engines. There used to be, they were pulled, wagons pulled by a horse, by horses. So it was old and it was a big building and had a pretty large yard. And the owner who we rented from was building a sailboat there. It was 40 feet. I don't know, 13 meters, 12 meters long. And it took him 10 years. He did it on the weekends. And at one point, so the sailboats, I know most of you probably know, have this deep keel, it's called, the part that goes into the water. What's the name of that? You don't know. What's the keel?
Curly.
Huh?
Curly.
It has a deep curly. And it's hollow, and it's filled with weight. And my landlord was taking the lead out of old batteries and putting it down in there. You know, thousands of kilos of weight in this thing. And so then when that keel is, heavy keel is in the water when you're sailing and the mast with the sails is up, it can lean way over and not capsize, not go over, because its balance, its sense of balance. So it's able to stay stable but still responsive to the wind. So that kind of image seemed very appropriate for this inner stability that we might find there. One of my someone I teach with quite a lot had an image that I want to borrow for talking about this that I thought was excellent, and I used this, I brought this up in one of the groups, this image of a skilled surfer as a good image for this quality of equanimity. So a really skilled surfer is able to they're right in the wave and they're responding to it constantly. They're so connected. I mean, they're in it. The board is right in it. They're in the wave. But they bring this, they have, you know, really good ones. They're relaxed. And they're bringing this spontaneous and very centered response to the changes. A wave is nothing but change. And some of them ride these huge waves. I don't know, are there waves? Are there surfers in... Are there waves that you can surf in Finland somewhere? Yeah. Where, in the south? Or?
It's at least in the south on the coast.
Yeah. And they're big enough to surf?
Yes, yeah. I've heard and seen some videos.
Yeah. So they're not resisting the conditions. If they resist it, they're going to go down. Wipeout. Called Wipeout. When I was a kid, there was a song. It was an early rock and roll instrumental song with this drum solo that was called Wipeout. And it was kind of, there was a surf music scene really big in the 60s, and it was about getting wiped out on a surfboard. And it reminds me, one time I was visiting one of my friends who's, at that time his son was a teenager, 15, 16, something like that. And someone had given him this board, which some of you maybe have seen or played with. It looks like a skateboard, a long board, but it has no wheels, and it's got a roller that it fits on, and there are blocks on the bottom so it won't slip off, but it moves on this roller. Have you seen something like that? They might have it in a gym or something. But I think snowboarders and skateboarders might use it to kind of train, or it's good for old people to keep their balance because they start to lose it. And so I was trying this thing, and so I brought it up near the wall, and I kind of got up on it, and I was holding to the wall and trying to find the balance point in the middle, and then at some point I realized, oh no, that's not what I do. I have to. I got to be careful. I have to relax, bend my knees, soften my gaze, and keep moving. That's the only way. And so I couldn't do it very well, but I got a little better at it. My friend's son, he could just hang out up there, texting his friends, on his cell phone, and he was so loose, and it was so nothing to him. It was very cool to see, but it was this, it's like, oh, that's what I have to do. Because at first I thought, okay, there's a middle point there, and I've got to find it. But it's a movable thing. There is no fixed point. So it's important that we understand, get a sense for what equanimity isn't, because sometimes there's confusion when we hear this. When we hear descriptions of this quality of mind, because we can think that it somehow is some, that we're kind of figuring out a way to not feel things or to keep things away or to somehow separate ourselves so that we're not touched by things, and then we can be sort of unaffected by things. But it's not that. It's actually, those are, That kind of shutting down or attempts to deny reality are actually manifestations of aversion. And equanimity is actually this, I think of it as this radical acceptance of the truth of things. It rests on that, on total connection, like the surfer has to be completely, totally present and connected to the wave. So it's actually the opposite of any kind of denial or suppression. And as the sublime abiding, the Brahma Vihara, it gets confused with a sort of indifference or a kind of attitude of just not caring. As though somehow, if this gets developed in us, we won't feel anything. We'll just get kind of numb and, we're detached, but we're not alive in a certain way. People often have this fear, oh, if this gets strong, I won't care about anything anymore, I won't enjoy beauty, I won't feel anything at all. But that's not the case in any way. That's not what it's about. That's called the near enemy. We mentioned the near enemies of these things. Kind of looks a little bit like equanimity, but it's actually not it at all. But it can resemble it in some ways, and it can cause us to be confused. So it's totally connected and with life, but we're not being pushed and pulled around by patterns of reactivity in the mind. We have this inner stability and strength. And so this is actually the effect it has in our lives, is that it frees up a lot of energy for us that is bound up in these reactive patterns, and allows us to respond from a place of more clarity and wisdom and stability, but from balance. And so you could say that it frees up internal energy to then be applied to responding to external conditions that come our way. Really great in that way. And given the current state of things in the world, this quality is, it's always essential. It's maybe more essential than ever, because we're going to have to respond to all kinds of things. And if we can do that from a place of clarity and balance, then our actions will be so much more effective than if we're responding, if we're reacting from anger or things like that. So you could say that it allows our intelligence, wisdom to arise and to function. It allows compassion to infuse our vision. And we can see what's to be done, if there is something to be done, when to act, how to act, what to do. And our actions are can be full and effective and infused with caring connection, born of compassion, of seeing the way things are, understanding what drives, what's driving the minds of people. You see, oh, okay, I see now. I don't have to rage against this injustice I see. So it gives us this strength and this kind of protection against what are called the worldly winds blowing through our lives of changing fortunes. And often it's so unpredictable. You know, blame might come to us when we're just trying our best to be helpful. I've certainly had that experience. Trying my best to be of service and being blamed in some way. Or gain may come out of a situation of apparent loss. And so as we've been saying over and over, and I think we keep saying this, people keep saying these things over and over because it takes a while for things to sink in, but change is one of the few things we can rely on in life. We'll talk on this truth of impermanence. That we can count on, not a whole lot else. And everything is unfolds out of this causal flow, causes and conditions. It's all flowing on. And largely, not completely, but largely, it is out of, it's not something that we're directly in control of. We can't say, I'm going to have it go only this way. Because there's always new causes and influencing that, where it's out of our direct control for the most part. So if we are in a situation where we aren't in control, and we can't put a stop to the arising and passing and all the changes, then we're going to have a different strategy. If we're going to find any sense of ease and empowerment and strength in the face of the changes that life brings us, we have to have a different approach than resisting the truth of that. So we have to learn to ride the changes, to harmonize, come into alignment with the reality, the truth of change. And so how do we do this? How do we, what are the, just in sitting, one sitting period, a lot of waves coming through there, from this side and this side. We're feeling great, and then we're feeling horrible, and everything comes together and it falls apart. How do we deal with that? One period of meditation, a day here on retreat, our life. So this, the power of mindfulness, sati, mindful awareness. You know, it's such a simple thing. Just feel it right now through Just ask the question in your mind, is there awareness? It brings that presence right there. And touch it, taste it, sense that. It's not a big deal. And yet it's profound in terms of its implications and what its potential in our lives in the world. You know, these meditation instructions, think back to the very first ones you ever got. The very first time you were ever given instructions in meditation. Now maybe you, it could have been, there's all kinds of things. Maybe you were given a mantra and told, repeat this. Maybe you were, all kinds of things. But at least the kinds of instructions and insight in Vipassana meditation, you know, we're pretty much told, okay, notice what's happening. Open up to your experience. Something like that. You know, maybe using an anchor, some place to kind of stabilize our attention. But, you know, you open to what's arising. Bring mindfulness to what's arising. Pleasant and unpleasant things. And pleasant sounds good. But why would I want to open up to painful sensations? Or nasty mind states. You know, I don't come to the retreat. Oh, I think I'll go sit with painful physical sensations and troubling mind states for a week. If we put that, come sit with aches, pains, and nasty mind states. Yay! You know, are you all just, oh yeah! Nobody would come if we advertised it that way. You know, we want bliss and light and peace and, wait, that's what we want, right? That sounds good. We don't want that other stuff. And it's not that that's the only thing, but, you know. Well, maybe none of you had any of those unpleasant sensations this week. Or, you know, difficult mind states, your mind telling you what a worthless, good, you know, just how worthless you are. Or whatever. All the stuff in between. Yeah, there is bliss, peace, love, and light. But it's not the whole thing. And so, you know, we sit down and teach, okay, if unpleasant something, open to that. If aversion arises in your mind and you hate everything, everything, including the voice of the stupid teacher who won't shut up in front of the hall, open to that. I can't tell you how many times I've sat where you're sitting and what I was noting was hating, hating, hating. I'm using the mental hating. That's good practice, but it doesn't necessarily feel like a lot of fun when you're doing it. It can seem like, well, something went wrong. You know, clearly they made a mistake if they want me to be with this. So, especially when we're new to practice, it feels like if things are difficult or unpleasant, we must be doing something wrong. Or the instructions are wrong. Or they're evidence that there's something wrong with us. We just can't do it right. And, you know, of course we get the range of all of these things, but if our strategy in our meditation practice in our life is to fight against what's difficult, then we're going to add this resistance and tightening. The Buddha, in one teaching, he called it the second arrow. So the painful sensation, the painful mind state, that's the first one. That's unavoidable sometimes. If we have a body, there's going to be a painful feeling. But then we take our bow and arrow and we shoot another one in there. But we don't see we're doing that. We put a second dart of resistance, of struggle and fight there. It makes it twice as hard to be with. And so, And when we try to hold on to the pleasant, which doesn't stay, then there's this burn of clinging, like the rope burn I described at some point. And so if we, as we learn to let go of struggle, then there's a lot of suffering that falls away. The painful sensation, that's going to be there, as well as the pleasant one, but we don't add this extra resistance and aversion, and when pleasant falls away, we don't suffer from this burn. And so we know these things for what they are, and we can be with what's difficult without it destroying our peace of mind, and we can be with the changing nature of what's beautiful and pleasant, because we know that it's going to change. But it doesn't lead us to falling into despair or unhappiness. This is this balance that's possible here. And so mindfulness is this training to be able to connect to, open to all experience, pleasant, unpleasant, neither of those. And we learn over time that it's not good waves and bad waves, it's just waves. And we learn how to start riding these waves. We train the mind to have this bigger perspective so that no one wave has that much power over us. It's like this ability to ride them. And this points us towards this possibility of this mind that is our true friend, our best friend, as the verse of the poem said. Oh no, I'm nowhere near the end. And so we find this refuge there in the mind and heart. It goes with us everywhere. And so, like, we're not a master surfer to start. We have to probably stand up on the beach and just even try standing up with a board that isn't moving. And we have to fall and get back on over and over. And there's so much patience and perseverance and willingness to start again. Did anyone have to start again today? Maybe twice? How many times over this week did you have to start again? I mean, hundreds for me. It's... You only
about,
had to?
352. Okay.
Yeah. Marie's got this incredible mind. Like she just, it's like a steel. Just 2,379 times she had to start it. That was just this morning.
No, every day.
Daily. So there's things we can do to help support this. We can. When we live a life with this engagement with a life of integrity and an ethical life, then this virtue that comes from that brings balance to the mind, because we're not filled with remorse and guilt for our actions, and we have this sense of being blameless. The bliss of blamelessness, said that you can go into any group and feel blameless. What a gift to oneself. And we cultivate strength in the mind through the meditation practices. And that stability that's developed through concentration and calm that come lets us actually connect with reality and start to be able to rest there without struggle. Reflecting on our good qualities is really good, because we will tend to see our flaws and everything that's wrong with us so easily. But to actually intentionally bring our good qualities to mind is really helps balance our view, because our view is often very unbalanced. And we will dismiss and diminish our goodness and just not see it. Or just say it's not really, because look how bad I am. So that doesn't really count. It's an unbalanced view. The Buddha frequently recommended that we bring our good deeds, our wholesome activities and actions, bring these to mind. Reflect on them. In one teaching, he told this person, reflect on them when you're at home, when you're at work, when you're with your kids, when you're doing pretty much every time, anywhere you are, constantly reflect on them. There's this deep kind of equanimity that the mind opens to at times. It's sometimes called six-limbed. It's equanimity that arises at all six sense doors. Sometimes called six-limbed, or equanimity regarding all formations, all that comes in the mind, in the world. And Marie talked about, the Buddha assailed by the armies of Mara on the night of the Enlightenment. And then one of the texts says, all these things, torments and seductions and doubt, finally was the one Marie focused on. Who do you think you are? And that's when he touched the earth. And it said, the Great One's mind was not moved by all of this. Didn't land anywhere. All of those torments and everything else there. And so we don't start there. We get there gradually. So I want to finish with this quotation from a book on the Brahmaviharas by Sharon Salzberg. To have the radiant calm and unswayed balance of mind that we call equanimity is to be like the earth. All kinds of things are cast upon the earth, beautiful and ugly things, frightful and lovable things, common and extraordinary things. The earth receives it all and quietly sustains its own integrity. It is a state of peace to be able to accept things as they are. This is to be at home in our own lives. We see that this universe is much too big to hold on to, but it is the perfect size for letting go. Our hearts and minds can become that big, and we can actually let go. This is the gift of equanimity. So let's just have a minute of quiet meditation.